This is number 10 in our survey through the book of Revelation. We are now at, in the middle of the seven churches, the letter to the church in Philadelphia. This is Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13. It reads, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world, to try those who dwell on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So that is the letter to the church in Philadelphia. Any thoughts on it before we go into it?
A real simple question that I'm slowing to take up is, and to the angel of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Have they all started that way?
They have.
So it's the angel of the church, not, I thought it was the angel's message to the church. It's the church's angel.
In the introduction to this particular scene, the first scene, first act of Revelation is the seven letters. At the very end, as the passage setting up this scene, it described the seven angels of the churches.
Of the churches. So are those the leader to the magistrate of the church? What is it?
It's very unclear and ambiguous as to what exactly it means.
It's the angel of the church. Now the seven angels and the three angels' message, you know that?
They're different.
That's different. That's two, not of. So it's not the angel bringing the message to the church, it's Jesus bringing the message to the angel.
Right. And the angel simply means a messenger.
To the messenger of the church.
Okay. And there's some question as to what this angel represents. We talked about this way back in the very beginning as in the introduction to these series of letters. The angel could mean, literally, a supernatural being who is keeping watch over each of the churches. It could mean the person who actually brought the letter to these churches. It could mean one of the leaders at each of these churches.
Maybe the person in charge of communication?
Maybe the person who's reading these letters. The book of Revelation does not give a clear indication as to what is truly meant by each of these angels at the churches.
That's just the first time it clicked on me as of versus to. I'd always thought of the word to.
Yeah.
I always have a problem with the "I am coming soon, hold fast." You know, what is it that is important for everybody to feel like, hurry, hurry, get up, or, it's imminent for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important to feel like it's imminent? And I understand a lifetime, or, you know, if your life's cut short, you only have that life, so make good use of it. But I just don't, when he says, I am coming soon, I mean, that's pretty clear, right? Hold on, your rope's breaking, but I'm coming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And how thin can that last thread get, you know?
Well, it doesn't really track in Revelation, but the pastor down at Edmunds Church had been speaking for a number of weeks on the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And his thinking...
And it's here now.
...is the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven came and Jesus introduced it to them. Now, you are living in it now. Even though you have a frail body, even though you have a sinful world,
mm-hmm.
in your mind you can live the peace of mm-hmm. God in you now.
Okay, so that makes sense. You know, like, I'm...
As opposed to panic.
And this would be the Spirit, the Comforter that he promised to send. His, I am coming soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, if you take what the pastor in Edmunds was saying, what I was just alluding to, mm-hmm. you would think that in Revelation he should have said... Where yeah, I'm coming soon.
I will be with you soon.
I am with you. It should be rather than I am coming. It's just I have been with you since.
Uh-huh.
Well, we'll get into that towards the end. But see the little superscripts that are next to the verbs in the last few verses there, last couple of verses? The P's are present tense. S are future tense.
Oh, I have come. Hold that.
Okay.
That helps.
So
keep on holding.
Just I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the world to try those who dwell on the earth. I am coming present. So hold fast what you have.
I am coming like...
I have come.
I will come.
I have come. I will come. I'm here.
It kind of tracks with what the Edmunds preacher was saying. And that's the message I would bring to you from the little bit I saw down south. Is there's different churches down there. And there's some that we would be very encouraged by what Adrian presented.
Maybe the I am coming, maybe a better way to say it is what we sometimes hear is I am come.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, as you can see, there's a mixture of present and future tense, so it's both.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's the already and not yet is what theologians
that's
say.
That's what the Everett pastor was trying to portray, I think.
Yeah, that's
kind of like, I'm here, hold on. That makes sense. Rather than panic, it could be any minute.
Well, he prayed, if you read the beginning, if you go from the beginning instead of just picking something out of the middle, he reads in the beginning that he's opened a door which cannot be shut.
Uh-huh.
He shuts doors that cannot be opened. So these people are being praised for the fact that when he opened the door, they never let their eyes off of what can't be shut. And so for you to worry whether he is or isn't there or isn't coming is why he's going to be mad at you, because basically you should be at the beginning and always seeking that he is there with you at all times, and to hold fast all of what is taught and what is there for his patient endurance. And that's what he's asking. And then, you know, the only thing that's in the future is what you shall see when you've done that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a number of things to note. The idea of key and doors that are very prominent in this letter. So whatever it is, that seems to be one of the, pun intended maybe, keys to understanding this letter. There's no reproof, there's no warnings given in this letter. It's similar to the letter to Smyrna, the church in Smyrna.
The Smyrna is the second one?
The Smyrna was the second one, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the parallel.
Yeah, yeah. The sense I get is that perhaps this church is feeling a little discouraged. Even though they have been faithful, it doesn't feel like they're receiving the rewards that they think they were promised for their faithfulness. All they see are troubles around them.
So he's holding them up for everyone to see and saying, these guys are faithful. You should be like them. And that's going to be very encouraging to the people who hear this letter, especially when they're hearing all the other letters also.
Well, he's saying to them, you know, the power yet. He's basically saying, you know, those that are, what he's been claiming is that the people that are claiming that they're Jews and are not, are lying and losing their faith, and that he's going to have these people come bow at their feet because they've been keeping their promise to God and saying that they're, instead of trying to make their way in the world of Rome, cautiously, they're just keeping the faith that they have. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he is.
The reason for their discouragement appears to be primarily with a conflict with the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
Something to do with the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
We see quite a few parallel words and phrases in this letter with the letter to Smyrna. And the idea of name, the word name, the term name, is repeated at the end of the letter, so there's some kind of importance attached to that.
Well, Smyrna talks about those who say they are Jews and are not.
So, some historical background. Philadelphia housed temples of Artemis, Helios, Zeus, Dionysus, and Aphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
Some big Roman and Greek gods and goddesses. A 3rd century inscription from the Jewish synagogue there has been recovered. The church in Philadelphia, like the church in Smyrna, had apparently been expelled from the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
Exclusion from the synagogue could lead to more direct persecution by the Roman authorities, as in Smyrna.
Because if they weren't Jewish, then they didn't have that
They didn't have the protection, the excuse.
Mm-hmm. So now they're like off in no man's land.
Right, and so you've got these quite a few major pagan temples in the city, as well as a large Jewish population.
So this city had these temples. How old is those temples, that city at that time?
As we'll see, though, just a few little bit down, Philadelphia is located in earthquake country.
So they're not very old.
They're not very old. maybe they're located in spots that have been temples for a long time, but...
Well, the reason I'm asking is their culture and their Greek gods is probably not just a fly-by-night, it's probably centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the pantheon and the paganism is... The practices are... Very old.
Have a long history.
Thousands, probably.
Yeah. Okay. So we're introducing the Jewish and the Christian community is relatively Jewish is new. And
well, Jewish is old too. That's the one. That's the
not
one.
As old as Antioch.
But the community itself is not, but the religion goes back many, many, many millennia.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
okay. See, way before Jesus was
but
born.
But to introduce something new into a place like that.
Mm-hmm. The Israelites are the Jews, so it goes way back from Abraham.
I was thinking that the Greek gods would precede Moses.
No.
That's what I think I was trying to ask.
But the Greek deities incorporated many of the local deities.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go like that, then it goes back as far as people have histories. So in regards to the door and the key, in the Old Testament, in Jewish literature, the gates of Hades refer to the realm of the dead and thus the power of death. One who held the keys to these realms thus ruled over them. So whoever held the keys in a royal house held a position of great authority in that house, as in Isaiah 21:21-22, keys symbolized authority to control whatever they opened. So keys represent authority,
mm-hmm.
control.
Well, why didn't you say that? Why didn't you just say, what's your password?
The crown here...
Can I have it all encrypted?
The crown here alludes to the victor's crown received at the end of a race or for military exploits. It represents victory. God's remnant people appear as a new temple in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in various other New Testament texts. Pillars could be used to symbolize the people of God, as in Exodus 24:4, but were a natural feature of temples. Now you look at the old temples, especially in Greeks and Romans, you see these big pillars. And often the only things that remain in the ruins are the pillars.
Their form of construction, the pillars, were the most structural element.
Yeah. They were a natural feature of temples and often bore dedicatory inscriptions. And I guess that pillars on the Capernaum Synagogue had these inscriptions, just as military standards and other items bore inscriptions. So they have words written on them of describing different things. Philadelphia, as we just noted, is located in an earthquake-prone region. And the city apparently was destroyed in an earthquake, such an earthquake, in the year 17. In an appreciation for imperial reconstruction aid after that earthquake in 17, Philadelphia was briefly renamed Neo-Caesarea. In other words, Caesar's new city. Philadelphia lies near a fertile valley, especially suited for growing wine grapes. Inscriptions from Philadelphia mention worship of Zeus and Hestia, and the Roman imperial cult was already present in the first century AD. An inscription from a nearby town mentions a synagogue in that town. Christians in Philadelphia later received a letter from the early church father Ignatius, and they suffered during the martyrdom of Polycarp. So, not necessarily during this time, but within the next couple generations, there are documented examples of persecution in Philadelphia. So Philadelphia had taken on other names in the past. We just mentioned on Neo-Caesarea and Flavia during the reigns of Claudius and Vespasian. There are some parallels. This next table describes parallels between the letters to Smyrna and the letter to Philadelphia. There's talk the idea of death and life. In Smyrna, Jesus is described as one who died and came to life. And in Philadelphia, a possible allusion to death and life is the key to the open and shut doors. as we noted earlier, there's no criticism, no reproof in either of these letters. Both describe conflict with Jews. Both use the phrase synagogue of Satan. In Smyrna, the Christians are being slandered, perhaps related to the idea of name being, you know, being called names. The slander from Jews. In Philadelphia, the promises say, I will write on him. Now, Jesus will write on the faithful, his faithful followers, various names that relate to God. Both cities, both churches, there's a sense of helplessness. In Smyrna, the letter mentions something about, you know, your poverty. In Philadelphia, the letter says, you have but little power. But the reality is, in Smyrna, you are rich. And in Philadelphia, I have set before you an open door.
Mm-hmm.
Both mention coming trials. In Smyrna, for 10 days you will have tribulation. In Philadelphia, the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world. However, the target of the trials differ. In Smyrna, it's going to be the church that goes through the trials. In Philadelphia, the specific promise is that I will keep you from these trials, but rather the rest of the world, those outside the church, will go through a time of trial. Smyrna, in regards to these trials, what is the instruction? Smyrna, the Christians there are told, do not fear. In Philadelphia, I will keep you from the hour of trial. The duration is, in both cases, is, you know, rather than getting tied up with the specific number, more really is we, what we need to understand is that it's a short time. Smyrna, it was 10 days. In Philadelphia, it's an hour. The exhortation is similar to both. In Smyrna, it was be faithful. Philadelphia, it's hold fast. And the idea of crown comes up in both letters. In Smyrna, Jesus says, I will give you the crown of life. In Philadelphia, it's part of the exhortation, hold fast so that no one may seize your crown.
You said don't concern ourselves too much with the time element, but does this prophet, does this message have relevance to the actual church of Smyrna and Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we've always learned Revelation to be over time, in reality these were contemporary cities.
Right.
Has this message been fulfilled or experienced, or is it still valid for Smyrna and Philadelphia? And because I'm taking, there's two ways to read Revelation, but the one is, what was the message to Philadelphians? Mm-hmm. Is that still, was that fulfilled, or is it still being fulfilled, or to Philadelphians? Did their hour come?
Well, if there were, if there are documented trials,
the trial that is being described to Philadelphia is not targeting the church.
Mm-hmm.
It's targeting those outside the church.
Mm-hmm. Smyrna. We'll have tribulation. Did Smyrna
yes.
have tribulation?
Yes.
Okay.
And did
the tribulation.
Did it last 10 days or 10 years? Or
the 10 days is an allusion to the time of testing that Daniel requested in regards to his food.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with a period of time.
Okay, so even though we love to say a day of the year and a year of the day and all this stuff, it probably was not applicable in this
It's not applicable.
Okay. So are these prophecies, these messages, to be bluntly, is it done? Has it been accomplished? Has the era passed?
Probably, because each of these letters is specific to each of these churches at that during the first and second centuries.
Okay, so you're alluding that the first and second century would be the era of the message.
The era of the primary fulfillment.
Okay.
There may be applications.
Oh yeah.
In subsequent times.
So.
If there weren't, why would they even put it in the Bible?
So we can, in history, go to the experiences of those churches and observe how this transpired.
Probably. And another important thing to note about predictive prophecies in the Bible is that they are conditional. Now, how the people respond may alter not just how they are fulfilled, but maybe if the prophecies are fulfilled ever.
I was trying not to use the word prophecy and fulfilled. I was trying not to use those two words. I was trying to use the word the message. Yeah.
There's one school of thought in regards to biblical predictive prophecies is that they must all be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what do you do with Jonah?
Because obviously Jonah wasn't happy. They weren't fulfilled.
Well, the answer to that would be, well, God changed his mind perhaps at that particular moment, but Nineveh was destroyed.
Yeah, it did get destroyed later, but not in Jonah's expectations.
And he passed.
Okay, so there's two trains of thought, and that's okay.
Yeah, and school of thought is, prophecies are conditional. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, into the letter, Jesus self-identifies himself as first the Holy One. What is interesting about that phrase is it's not part of Jesus' description that's given in the opening chapter. Now, so far in the self-identifications, Jesus has used something that's already been written in chapter 1 of the book. So why here? Why now? Well, first of all, holy. The word holy in the Old Testament describes God. And holy can be attached to buildings, can be attached to objects, it can be attached to priests. Okay? In other words, it describes those things that are set apart for ritual and priestly activities. There's a clear distinction between what is holy and what is not in the Old Testament. There are ways to make things holy, and there are ways to defile holy things. The word holy, which can also be translated saint, depending on the context in the New Testament, describes all who are set apart for Christ. It's no longer descriptive of places or of objects. So, an example of that would be Jesus speaking to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. Uh-huh. So, this woman was asking, so which location, which building is holy? Is Jerusalem and the temple there holy? Or is it Mount Gerizim and the temple that we have there that is holy? And Jesus' response is,
it doesn't matter.
Neither.
Okay.
it is not no longer objects and places that are holy, but it is whether a person is responding to the Spirit or not that makes that person holy.
That would be extremely
radical
to a Jewish mind.
But do you see why that might be important in this letter in relation to the synagogue and the Jews?
Yeah, because he's siding on the Christian side versus the Jewish synagogue. Mm-hmm. He's putting the importance on the people rather than the building. And to Jewish thought, that would be sacrilegious. That's horrible. Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, in a roundabout way, gives us maybe the accusation that the Christians were feeling from the Jews in Philadelphia.
Just think of their conflict, though. A Christian, specifically a Jewish Christian, he obviously knows the temple's holy. I mean, he grew up that way. It's in their culture, it's in their blood. To abandon that.
That's the center of your life. That building is the center of your life. And for someone to abandon the holy structure would be sacrilege. And then Jesus comes along and says, I'm talking to you. I am the Holy One.
I am the Holy One. Oh. So he said he's the Holy One, not the temple.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that what he's really saying?
Yeah. One of the themes of Revelation is to transfer or to reinforce the idea that Jesus is God. Now, there may have been questions about whether Jesus was truly God or not at that time.
Because he was so recently a guy living in a town, and it would be difficult for people to identify him as God.
So in the Old Testament, it was God that was always described as holy and the one who can make things holy.
And here it says the words of
now,
God.
In Revelation, as John is writing, in this case, the words being spoken by Jesus, Jesus is making clear that he is God and he is holy and he can make things holy.
Is describing a person as holy a new thing in the New Testament or even the post-Jesus time? Did Jesus describe people as holy? Did the Old Testament?
The Old Testament, the priests were holy.
That's true.
But they underwent meticulous, a whole series of rituals.
Yeah, but they were an object in the temple. They weren't considered people. They were considered an object.
They were part of the temple.
Yeah, it was a system. But they weren't people. And so what I'm seeing is...
But describing believers... Well, he doesn't really do that.
He does, because what he did in the Old Testament is God is holy, and if you think of the Old Testament and the sanctuary and the temple and the wilderness and all that stuff, anything associated with God was considered holy, and you couldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. And what he's saying here is in the New Testament, Jesus says, I'm holy, and rather than it's the building, it's my followers that are holy. So it's in the Old Testament, it's God and His building. In the New Testament, it's Jesus and His people.
So where do they start actually describing believers?
When they said saints.
Acts.
In Acts. Okay.
So.
The second self-description is the true one, which is similar to how Jesus is described as in chapter 1, verse 5, as the faithful witness. Perhaps this is a counter to verse 9 of chapter 3, where the letter here reads, those who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Basically. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is contrasting himself versus those of the synagogue. Again, saying he is telling the truth. And those, the Jews, who cling to the synagogue, are telling lies. So one of the battles that this church is facing is between what is true and what is false.
There's a phrase that's popping in my head, I can't place it. Don't call holy what I have called. Don't call
holy common. If I call it holy, don't.
Yeah, don't call common what I have called clean.
Oh, is that coming out of the Peter?
It is. So, the sheet with the all sorts of creatures.
Mm-hmm. If I say the Gentiles are clean, they are.
Speaking of holy, Romans 1:7, to all who in Rome are, who are loved by God and called to be his holy people.
Yeah.
It called the believers holy.
Paul's letters, throughout, pretty much all of them,
the believers.
Christians are consistently referred to as saints.
Uh-huh.
Okay, not sinners.
Now.
Not sinners. Christians are referred to as saints.
But I believe what's trying to be said here is, in the Christian era, they called the people saints, i.e. they call them holy.
Holy.
And in a Jewish vernacular, that would be sacrilegious, to call a person holy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, the temple's holy.
And those who are serving it,
the priest,
must be holy. They are not holy by virtue of simply being associated with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They are allowed to serve because they have become holy.
They have made themselves holy, and so they are good enough to serve
him. Huh. I mean, we wouldn't do this. I mean, that's something that we haven't grown up. I don't call you St. Mark. But
that's what Paul called all of his people, you know, all the Christians.
But
you are a saint.
In today's world, there are other connotations
to
the word.
But
yeah, there's some baggage associated with the word saint.
But in reality, what we're saying is Holy Mark.
And Holy Jerry and Holy everyone else here.
I can see how that could... That, you know, when...
I always think of the H-O-L-Y as W-H-O-L-Y, Holy God. You know, you're Holy God.
See, I'm kind of not offended, but I don't appreciate
it. Set apart for God's use.
But accordingly, we all are. But I'm not offended, but I'm always a little bit uncomfortable with Mormons when they come around and say, Elder so-and-so, and Elder so-and-so, and Elder so-and-so. And so in reality, but what they're doing in Christian era, calling each other saints, which in their vernacular would be calling each other holy, to a Jewish mind would have been very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And much more sacrilegious than when we hear the Mormons being called elders.
Right. So that does kind of put in a little bit of perspective. I could see there'd be a big difference between a Christian and a Jewish culture. I could see they could be in conflict.
Well, see, in the Adventist and probably other Christian mindset, when you say elder, well, first of all, elder means be nice to your elders. I mean, you know, respect your elders. That means somebody older. Elder means older, mm-hmm. in one regard. In another regard, it's a sacred duty in the church, and you have to have one wife, and you have to have an evolving Mormon, you know, anyway. So.
And once a person has attained that, they deserve extra respect.
And I always felt like I could call them missionaries, but I couldn't quite make the hurdle of elder, but...
But I'm just saying there's a similar conflict in the Jewish culture versus the Christian culture. There could have been a similar mm-hmm. conflict.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did they call each other saints? They're referred to generally as saints.
But maybe not
the church churchgoers.
Probably not. They probably refer to each other as brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
but their
brother Mark, sister.
But their identification as to who they are in Christ is they are holy. No, which is something that Christians have lost.
To believe in your head, you know, that you're a son.
How do Christians identify themselves primarily?
By going to church.
They identify themselves as sinners.
Yeah, we're sinners, and hopefully, maybe, when it's all done said, maybe I'm
we can
saved.
Be good enough.
And Paul would. You would see steam coming out of Paul's ears if he heard that.
Because he's always believed that we're always right in God and it's our choice.
We're part of
you. In his gospel understanding, your identification as a sinner ends the moment you accept Christ.
You were a sinner. And that gives you confidence now. That makes the kingdom of God now. That makes Christ indwelling now. Not, I hope, in the future.
Not something that might possibly happen in the future if we can accomplish it.
Well, if you live, there is something about your mindset to believe you're no good and you're a sinner and you can't overcome.
Well, to believe
and
to believe that our own effort and our own innate goodness is not where it comes from. Yes. But to cling to the identification of being sinners is a different.
I like your comment to cling to it because I think that is not constructive.
To acknowledge that that is where we came from and that our own effort has nothing to do with it. Our own contribution is not what makes us good.
So God has made us clean and we shouldn't go around saying we're dirty.
Yeah.
We don't walk down the streets with a rope beating ourselves on the back.
God said, here's my rope. I love you. Be mine. And we go, oh, but I'm really Satan.
Are you sure you love me? Are you sure you love me? Would you quit asking? Are you sure you love me?
I'm not so sure you do.
The Christian identity should be, we are saints. We are holy ones who still struggle with previous habits. But we're saved.
Then done.
That's done. There's no question there.
That throws away your future. Jesus is coming soon. It throws that out.
Jesus is here.
Yes.
So,
he came, with us.
Continuing here.
We'll let you go in next phase.
The self-identification continues. The one who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. And as we noted already, the previous allusion to key is found in chapter 1, verse 18, where it's in the context of the keys of death and Hades. There Jesus has authority over death itself. See, death is no longer the most powerful force in this world. Jesus has victored over death. In this letter, in the letter to Philadelphia, the key is most closely associated with David. It's the key of David. And this is an allusion to Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22, which reads, "And I will place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open, and none shall shut, and he shall shut, and none shall open." You know, the words, the phrasing, the order of all of this is pretty much identical to what to the self-identification. So Isaiah and the letter to Philadelphia is almost the same in regards to that verse and phrase. The context of Isaiah 22 is that God allowed the destruction of Jerusalem because her leaders were unfaithful to him. Even though they attempted to strengthen fortifications by their own strength. One of those leaders was Shebna, the king's steward, who is representative of an unfaithful leader who attempted to provide security for himself through his own efforts. Isaiah's prophecy tells Shebna that his preparations will be for naught. In his stead, Eliakim will be promoted by God to Shebna's position. God will transfer the authority that Shebna had over Jerusalem and Judah to Eliakim. God will give him the key of the house of David. God will fasten Eliakim like a peg in a secure place. So,
I need an explanation of what's going on.
This is Isaiah 22, chapter 22.
Okay, was Isaiah written contemporary to King David?
Isaiah, it's the time of around the time of Hezekiah and Manasseh.
Long after David.
Long after.
Okay, so who is? Okay, go ahead.
This is Isaiah prophesying that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. No matter how much military preparation you may make.
So who was the king? It wasn't David.
It wasn't, no. It doesn't really matter. It really doesn't matter.
Okay.
We
know Shebna is the king. So, the point of this is that the unfaithful leaders are going to discover that all the preparations that they've made don't stop the destruction from coming upon Jerusalem.
Well, it sounds like Shebna, rather than protecting the city, he tried to protect himself.
Yeah.
It's both. Because his security is in his position.
He was securing the city to protect his position. I think that's what we do in our country, too. With TSA.
So, Eliakim.
Eliakim.
Eliakim. God put in, after the city fell and all that, supposedly. What is the key to the house of David? Since David is long gone, what is the key of the house of David?
Well, house of David is the royal line, the royal house.
Uh-huh.
The key is the authority over the royal line.
Mm-hmm.
The king steward is like the chief of staff of the president in this country.
So the house of David is God's elect. So if you want to be in God's elect,
no, key is authority over the house of David. Authority. Authority over all that the house of David has.
And he's going to make him secure in that position. So Eliakim is probably more important than the king at this point.
You know, it's funny because the President of the United States is considered, you know, for better or for worse, right or wrong, the most powerful man on earth.
Mm-hmm. But the Chief of Staff?
Yeah. Who's next in line? Now, who has the most power next to the President? In fact, who actually has more power over the President? The chief of staff.
He controls who sees
it. Yeah. Yeah. The chief of staff controls what information gets to the president.
The president is responsible for choosing the chief of staff and putting his confidence in right, wrong, or whatever.
Who is the chief of staff?
That's a good question. I don't know. See, that's the thing. Most people.
It's that person. So we have a figurehead, and there's powerful people behind him.
Invisible, powerful people.
Yeah, the truly powerful operate behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like that years ago.
In a lot of settings.
What does this say about Jesus, about this key of David? All previous human leaders of Israel came and went. But Jesus remains. And Jesus receives his authority from God, and his authority is over true Israel. Jesus is the one who opens the door to the true temple, and Jesus is in charge of the new Jerusalem.
So this, so Isaiah is saying that Eliakim is going to receive the key to the house of David, open and no one will shut, etc. And Jesus is now claiming that. Position.
Yeah, because what the prophecy in Isaiah 22 says is that even Eliakim, as faithful as and good as he may be, cannot prevent the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem.
What I'm seeing more and more is that in our culture today, a lot of our communication, and I'll just illustrate, is based upon the songs of musicals or phrases from movies or phrases from relatively current history, and everybody knows those songs or those things. And when
the people he's talking to knew this
verse
from Isaiah the way we know lines from Sound of Music.
Exactly. And
but
so,
see, those movies also were written to to certain specific
issues
things.
Of the day.
Issues, yeah.
Right.
And when someone uses a line from a movie, you think of the whole setting and what's around it. And they would do the same. They would think of when Jesus claims this identification, they would think of a lion.
And so there's a whole built-in message in that reference that we would...
Those are pretty cool.
And also when Jesus said he would destroy the temple and in 3 days remake it, that was just like the most terrible thing to say.
Right, but we know what that says in our mind, but in a Jewish mind it probably says a lot more than what we get out of it.
To them the temple was ultimate holy...
The temple was where God resided.
Just about became God. And they were transferring that to people rather than to building. Or,
transferring that to individual, ordinary people. As opposed to, big, fancy-dressed authorities. Talking about the invisible power behind the throne, they're transferring that to the guy in his shop next door.
And what do you think?
The holiness, the power to, to be holy and to be part of God, is transferred from the priest in the temple to the guy in the shop next door. Ordinary.
Is that
people. No, I mean ordinary people.
Oh, okay.
Ordinary people become holy and become God's.
And it's not only just the guy next door, it's the guy that is going against the church of the day. The rebellious person is the one that's elevated.
Yeah, the one that you would look down on.
Yeah.
This probably plays a lot into the mindset of our Western Christianity versus Middle East Orthodox Muslim Arab thinking. Probably has similar different perspectives. For us, people are the most ultimate important thing. To a Middle Eastern, I would suspect that location and buildings and heritage is more important than the individual.
Yeah, for the Middle Easterners, property is the most important. Property and family, the tribal group. The property belongs to the family, to the tribe. Honor and shame is very important. You maintain your family honor at all costs.
The individual is...
Individuals are not that important.
Like a honeybee, doesn't do much. They're a worker bee.
So the church situation is simply, I know your works. Basically, you have kept my word and have not denied my name. You remain faithful. That's the works.
We all want to be Philadelphia.
The church situation is also that they have access to an open door. It's been interpreted in a number of ways. One is that, it's an open door to new mission and outreach. Well, given the context, that's kind of stretching things.
I don't think those words existed in this.
That is very true. It's mission and outreach was probably not part of their context there.
Maintaining their lives was probably the height of...
So more likely than it was referring to the implied expulsion from the Jewish synagogue. In other words, that's the closed door. They were expelled from the Jewish synagogue, which subconsciously and perhaps very consciously they thought was an important place to be. But that door is now closed. Judaism was once thought to be the avenue of access to God, and that is now closed. So what? So what do Christians do without the synagogue? Well, the message in this letter is that I, Jesus, am that door that gives Christians access to God.
I am the door.
Every
I am the way.
Has their own door to God. And it's open, and you have free access. And
You don't have to go through these other doors because I have closed it.
You don't have to go to a specific place that is holy and intentions because you are holy.
Yeah, I
God
have
is holy. There's an open door.
And I have closed these past means of getting to God, and they are never going to be open again. Because I am the door. The open door.
What you're implying here is there was a change.
There was a change.
A door was closed and locked and another door was opened.
And how do you... I am God, I never change.
He never changes, but people change.
The means that he uses can change. That doesn't mean he changes.
Don't put that ready. The means of salvation changed.
The means which God uses to reach and draw people to Him may change, but the motives behind why God operates the way He does not change.
And the means of salvation itself isn't what's changing. It's the way.
And the important part isn't that you go keep trying the doorknob of the locked door. It's go through the other door and don't worry about the locked door.
It's like God was creating. It's like Moses even created this big, a big frame around the door to try and show people where it was.
Funnel.
And then once that was gone, people thought the door had disappeared and there wasn't any longer the big fancy temple around the door. It was just the door itself.
Earlier... we were talking about when we repeat and say what we think about and solidifies it. I think I tricked you on that.
That's probably good.
Wasn't he alluding to the door and keys being a control of death and everlasting life?
That's part of it.
So isn't he basically saying that the beginning, the middle, and the end, he created us as his beneficiary. He created mankind perfectly in his mind because God doesn't make a mistake in the first place. And it's through our own transgression that we lose sight of God. And his picture of us has always been perfect. And Paul has always said that our relationship with him will be perfect if we choose it to be. So what he's saying into the Christian community here is, and all humankind, is that the door is opened because he is trying to let you know that your perfect relationship with him exists, always has existed, and will exist if you choose it with him at all times. There's no place to do it. There's no means to do it by. There's no written, recorded, or human effort that can make that except for a place in your mind with this heart and that it only. There's no doctrine. There's no nothing that makes anything any better than the relationship that you carry with him. Only that's the everlasting life. That's the door that's been opened and it's always been there. The one that's shut is just the transgression that we carry with us that makes it impossible for us to have that relationship, or somebody's other means that we need to follow and abide by so that they can see whether or not we have a relationship with Christ that they prefer in their mind to be the right one.
To rephrase what you said, I think is that originally at the Garden of Eden, God created human beings and we had a daily communion with God. Mm-hmm. And he wanted that one-to-one open communication, and that continued even after the garden to a degree. But we degraded to such a point that, and this is me talking, Moses created a framework that would bridge between the fallen nature of man to God, and that when Jesus came, he says, okay, we went through Moses' bridge. Now let's get back to the real one-to-one communication mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The church situation is also that the church itself feels powerless. That's the perception of themselves. Perception is not reality. They think they are powerless because they have no means to influence the civil authorities. Now, if they had more wealth, positions of power, they could influence the authorities to make themselves more acceptable without having to kowtow to paganism.
A lot of organizations don't think they can exist until they have a building. They really cannot have an influence on the community.
And they've also lost the religious cover that Judaism had provided them. So if they aren't Jews, who are they?
Oh, this ringing so close to home.
Well, throughout the Old Testament, God says he cares for Israel. And Jews are the natural evolution of Israel. So does God love them? Does God love the Church of Philadelphia if they are no longer Jews? Mm-hmm. Perhaps in their expulsion from the synagogue, the Jews accused them of being abandoned by God.
And
that's why
they're
called. Yeah.
But in spite of their feelings and their perhaps even their doubts, they have remained faithful to Jesus.
Well, I know in like are circumstances here, you can you can just keep on thinking about rejection or something, but you can also think of the sweetness of being able to study and having freedom to study and learn, you know. So as far as having a name, it's really not that important. The Holy One.
So, and continuing their situation is that they are, you know, as noted earlier, they faced conflict with the Jews. They were expelled from the synagogue. They're no longer Jews. They're pressed the accusation that they were rebelling against God. You know, and as a result, God hated them, that God was angry with them.
Well, and you know, I'm talking about kind of a trite thing. Nobody's persecuting us, and nobody, but they suffered in reality, mm-hmm. you know, because here they are in no man's land. They're wide open to be really persecuted by this country.
But there's this thing in the back of my mind that keeps coming back. There is absolutely no value in rebellion. There's no value for them to be a word giver or whatever. If you, a Christian on the street, a pagan on the street, a Jew on the street, side by side, what value is it to be a Christian? Did they have the character of Jesus? Did they have love? Did they have compassion? Did they have characteristics that have value?
They were faithful, so that sounds like they did.
Yeah, it is personal. Yeah.
So this letter, Jesus tells the church in Philadelphia the reality to counter their perception. The reality is that those who expelled them are synagogue of Satan. Those who expelled them are not true Jews. By implication, the true Jews then are the true Israel, who are those who follow Jesus. And Jesus will vindicate his people. And Jesus loves them, in spite of what anyone may tell them. The exhortation is found in the middle of the promises is simply hold fast what you have. Similar to kept my word or kept my word about patient endurance. The church has Jesus. That's the main point. And they've remained faithful to him. And that's what really matters. The promises are, I will keep you from the hour of trial. In Smyrna, we noted that there was a phrase, you know, they will be tested or undergo trial for 10 days. Philadelphia is, because you have endured, you will be kept from the hour of trial. In regards to this hour of trial, we note that only the unfaithful will go through it. It may be perhaps some of the tribulations that are described later in the book, the book of Revelation. Perhaps it is about the final judgment. I think the important thing as we contrast Smyrna and Philadelphia is that just as the faithful go through trials which reveal their true natures, the unfaithful also go through trials to reveal their true natures. No one is exempt. Everyone goes through trials.
And maybe God doesn't point the trials at you saying, this one for you and this one for you, and we'll see who you really are. But trials happen to everybody, whether they are true or not.
So just thinking of churches' names, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is kind of on track if it has
it
right.
Actually.
If you were going to be biblically correct, we would be called the true Jew.
Well, true Israel.
Yeah. Second promise is, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And that there's a bit of similarity with Isaiah 22, verse 23, where it speaks of Eliakim, and I will fasten him like a peg in a secure place.
A peg or a pillar?
Well, third promise is
something secure.
The faithful.
Part of the structure of God.
The third promise is that the faithful never shall he go out of it, speaking of the temple. So together with the previous promise, it is a promise of eternal stability, very important in a region of physical instability. The physical lives were uncertain due to earthquakes and also of their nature of relationship with Rome.
Well, never to go out of the temple. In a Jewish, the temple was God holy, that was it. Uh-huh. And if that's transferred to the people, then what it's saying is you will never go out of...
You'll always be with God.
Yeah.
Wherever you are, whatever situation you're in the temple. Because it's not a physical building anymore, and it goes with you in your mind.
So does that answer Dolores' concern about his coming is imminent? It's even at the door?
Well, I think I've got it figured out now. I just need to keep remembering it instead of remembering my questions. Remember the answers instead. It's done. It's here. It's now.
It is finished already.
And then three promises dealing with names. I will write on him, the one who conquers, the faithful ones, the name of my God. I will write on him the name of the city of my God, which is the New Jerusalem. And I will write on him my own new name.
Are they going to be
tattoos?
Well,
there's a little hello name tag.
Yeah, hello name tag. Hi, my name is... No. The emphasis on names may have something to do with the multiple names that this city had during the recent number of years. It's an illusion. It would be familiar. It would resonate with the city that, and the church there.
Getting a new name.
It doesn't say that. It doesn't say your new name. It says God's new name.
I will write on him the name of my God.
Well, if one of the names of Philadelphia was Caesar's new city, Caesar wrote on them his...
Well, that's true. No, the statement says, I will write on him my own name.
Yes.
That's not my name, it's his name.
Yes.
And that was...
We talked about it, Hollywood and you're gone.
Is that going to
be Christian?
It has to do with the new name on the white stone.
Uh-huh.
That name is the new, my own new name. It's not the name of each person. It's God's new name.
And I don't think I remember that from school days.
Probably not.
School days, it was always...
No.
I thought it was always, everybody's going to get their new name, no. And you'll find out what it is.
That's a possible interpretation, but unlikely given the entire context of Revelation and what's being said here.
Now, if I opened up my King James Version, would it say my own new name or
simply new name in the letter to...
So did somebody add or omit my own?
Oh, no, in this letter it is my own new name.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. In the other letter it was a little more ambiguous.
In the letter, which one is that one? Pergamum, I think.
Uh-huh.
Third one, Pergamum. it speaks of being given a white stone with a new name.
Right.
So will we not know what this is until the white stone shows up?
Well, it sounds like from the context we discussed.
The white stone represents victory. It's given to victors, those who conquered, those who returned from a war victorious, and it is the admission ticket to the victory banquet.
So who's the victor, Jesus or us?
Jesus.
But, well, it's us. The Christians are the victors, the one who conquered. And the Christians are given, those who victor are given the admission ticket with the name of the host.
Oh, like your ticket would say 2012 Peter George Prom.
Something like that. Well, would the idea of giving a new name would be the basis of missionaries going into, say, native cultures and renaming everybody? Is that why they used to do that?
I know they did it, but I thought that because they couldn't pronounce the Aboriginal
name. Well,
maybe
that too. But they always, I remember hearing that.
Oh, they did?
Indigenous cultures were always renamed and they'd have.
Well,
they were because
heathen name and
pagan heathen names were often related to things
gods.
That their gods and things that they worshipped.
So just rename everybody and you'll eliminate the emphasis of cultural religious beliefs.
Well, we studied this at the beginning. When you name something, it's more, we just think it's a name, but...
No, a name represents authority and belonging and possession.
Right.
So when God said, when Jesus says, I will write on him the name of my God, it means you belong to me. When Jesus says, I will write on him the name of the city of my God, it's basically saying, you belong in my city.
And renaming Philadelphia Neo Caesarea, Caesar's new city, Caesar's own, that would be a tremendous status.
Thank goodness we don't do that. Washington, D.C. would change his name every 4 years.
But that would be a tremendous honor to be named Caesar's new city, and to
maybe
be,
for you.
Actually, that's where
for the city and its inhabitants.
Exactly why our country is having the problem that it's having right now is because each president was supposed to take on the name of the United States of America, not President Bill Clinton. Of the United States of America. It was more like a wife taking on the husband's name to caretake for that family in the honor of that name. And that's what our presidentship was and always should be thought of as. Is a
very valid point.
And no, we wouldn't be changing. And that's why we change it every 4 years. That's why that person's able to be let go, because he's not a monarch. He's not somebody
right.
that we're supposed to...
It's not his country.
Exactly.
And I think there's something to this in Genesis where it says that God, Adam named the animals. I think it's more than just naming the animals. I think there's something a lot more in there that we know.
Did he define them?
Well, God's command to Adam was what? To take care of his creation.
Did he help determine the character or something?
That's kind of what I think.
I think
that's where the diversity came from.
Naming also implies that the one named is a subject of the one naming. So Adam naming the animals means that all of the creatures of the earth, it symbolizes creatures of the earth are subject to mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So verses 11 and 12 are where I put the little verb tense notes. The idea of I am coming.
Well, I am coming.
And the new Jerusalem which comes, they're both in the present tense.
He is a chiistic structure because he's now answering the first question that we asked.
So even our study has been chiistic.
Is our language so restrictive in its tenses? Are other languages more colorful in their tenses? I don't know how to say it because we don't have it.
More free.
From what I've seen, Greek has a huge number of tenses as well as little modifiers, large number of modifiers. So the combination of verb tenses is huge.
So
they could say, I am here, I am coming, I will come, all of one word.
They have a thousand, the Eskimo has a thousand different ways of saying snow. Is it our industrial, our technological advances that we have to stream down communication so much that we actually are failing ourselves?
Part of it, I think, has to do with the Greeks were a very philosophical, intellectual people, and they wanted precise ways of communicating.
And we didn't have all those tenses back when we were pilgrims.
Well, we're going to lose our tenses because now we're going to be texting on the cell phone, which is simplifying our language so much that we lose a lot of this.
Well, language is more literary, it's more literal. Everything that gets written in one word is the literal word that was written down. It's not, there's no connotation, there's no genre, it's all just a very literal context.
Yeah, see, so kind of the illustration that I sort of thought about for this whole idea of I am coming is a person, a friend or family who says to you, I'm coming to visit you, and they're already on the plane. There is no question as to whether they will come or not. Mm-hmm. You know when they're coming. So they are coming.
Or they're calling you from the car in the driveway and they've been sitting there waiting for a while. And you just haven't answered the door.
And there's the thing that they can be with you right then and say, I'll be coming again. They're here, but they're going to come.
I think we're blind to is our technological advances is allowing us to simplify our language to the point that we are losing something that, and obviously we can't even see what we lose because what you don't know you don't have, you don't know you lost. But it's like in paintings, if we lose color. Now I can transmit black and white on TV real easy. To transmit color on TV is more difficult. And so are we losing, we're losing the ability to communicate in color. We're communicating absolutes, 1 + 1 = 2, but we're not communicating.
That's why they go back to
feelings
the original.
And senses.
Philosophical language. It makes sense that the language would have a lot more color. So we should all learn Greek
and Yeah, if we went from a childhood, we would have more color in our language, and we would have more beauty in our language instead of just precise knowledge, precise fact. So we are walking ourselves into a limited communication.
That's why we have Mark.
So I guess the point of these, this is, to note the verb tenses, is I am coming soon has a future aspect, but it's not, in Revelation, it's not limited to the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, he could be sitting in the kitchen and say, I'm coming soon. Again.
Or more fully.
And even about the New Jerusalem, which is in the present tense, New Jerusalem which comes. The city of God is, in some respects, already here.
Mm-hmm.
So, the description of the New Jerusalem that's found in Revelations 21, 22, part of that is already here.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of it,
that's what
Edmund, but some of it.
He was trying to develop or present.
And so that puts a whole different twist on the second coming.
Yeah, that pastor was definitely okay with people not agreeing with him. You know, he's like, I'm sure you have some ideas too, but this is my idea here, right now, presently.
So, this letter continues themes that have been largely repeated, that Jesus is God, and that Jesus' followers are the true Israel.
That's what I see. The transfer of God, church, being the temple, is God's church, is the people.
Some other concepts that this letter brings up is Jesus is the only true stable foundation. In other words, don't seek security from what's found in the world, from temporal things. Jesus is the only source of true spirituality and life. Jesus is completely faithful. He will claim his own. In fact, he has claimed his own, and he publicly acknowledges them. There's no secret with Jesus.
When was this written? When was this written?
Revelation.
90 to 95.
So none of those people ever saw Jesus.
Not physically with their eyes, no.
And they may have had letters or visits from Paul.
Yeah.
They may have had letters or visits from Peter. Didn't get up there. Timothy, maybe. Who had been up there?
The Asia Minor.
Other than Paul?
Peter may have been through there.
Okay, that's interesting.
And the final point is Jesus is already coming. That's probably the best we can do in English. The New Jerusalem is already coming. I think what that means is there's nothing we can do to hasten Jesus' coming.
It will be when it's to be.
It, because it already is. So Jesus is already coming. Jesus is already here.
Oh, wow,
that's
so hard to get into my head.
Let's try this. In today's culture, we get engaged, and then 6 months later, we get married. But in the Jewish culture, didn't they get married? Wasn't engagement the same thing as in marriage? And then a period of time later, they fit into a ceremony?
So they get betrothed at a big ceremony. The betrothal is the beginning of the joining of two houses.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, they are, for all intents and purposes, married. They are legally joined together.
Mm-hmm.
as far as the houses are concerned. What the groom then does after the betrothal is he returns to his father's house to build on an addition to where he can then bring his bride. The night of the wedding, which usually is about a year later, there's a big procession of the groom and all the friends who goes to the bride's house to take the bride and bring her home to his father's house.
So, betrothal, did I say it?
Yeah.
Betrothal is when you accept Jesus, and his second coming is when he's actually you're physically moved.
When he comes and picks us up to take us to his father's house.
Right. But during the interim, you are already part, the bride-to-be is already part of the groom's household. They may not be, they don't live together, but they are.
Do they visit?
Yeah, they visit.
The point is, he's saying that in the minds of the culture, legitimately, they are one.
She's like loaned back to her family
yeah.
for the interim.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of makes sense in what you're saying is he is coming. Well, you are married, you're just not there yet.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good illustration of the...
See, our culture's twisted this whole marriage thing because there's so many movies out there where somebody's like, oh, it's my fiance, but 5 years later they're still trying to figure out whether or not they should or shouldn't marry the person. So that's what our problem is.
But they've been coming together for 6 years.
Yeah.
But...
And I know this is a mundane question, but do they share the same bedroom after betrothal or after
no.
the marriage?
No.
After the marriage.
Which is why when, before Jesus was born, the neighbors didn't Mary would have been looked down on because even though she was betrothed, she wasn't supposed to be pregnant yet.
Well, you can't blame them. What did we say today?